Blog Talk Radio.
Masonic Exchange, you found us, and we found you. Thanks. This is your host for the next while, Dale Graham. And yes, I am a Freemason. And yes, I am a Canadian. And today, and as usual, enormously proud of what we've what we have, and feeling very humbled with the quality of life that we enjoy here in this country, not to be taken for granted. The as much as we like to stay engaged, the way we stay engaged with our country here is grumbling and watching and complaining like we do with the weather. It's like most of the rest of Canada sort of takes it as it is around the Toronto area. I'm a couple hours from there. It's playtime to complain about the weather as if it's an interruption. A truly amazing way of thinking about it. It's winter, and now the celebrations are whipping up around the estate here, and the old dog's curled up asleep not too far from me. We have, of course, Groundhog Day. Well, what's not to celebrate when if the little varmint sees it comes out on a cloudy day, we have an early spring, and we keep our fingers crossed. Right now, it's as cloudy as you can imagine. So a little global warming wouldn't hurt, just maybe a day or so, a little sunshine. Some of that Chinook that our friends out west will tell us about, not happening here in Ontario. Nice, beautiful, but fabulous scenery around all those gray tones. It's like an old-time photograph, isn't it? Something from the 30s or 40s or 50s. Just enormous. Je suis Charlie Hebeau, as I mentioned, and enough said about that. I want to talk to you about, I don't know if you need anything, you're up for a little mischief about Groundhog Day and all what that means. Well, I suppose we can, talk about that just a little bit. Of course, you know, something like that just piques the attention of us Canadians. And of course, we have our own, you know, we're going to use a foreign varmint, you know, we're going to use our own. So we've got Wyarton Willie snoring away up at Wyarton. This is celebrated every February 2nd. And according to folklore, it's a cloudy day when a groundhog emerges from its... Then spring will be early. If it's sunny, the groundhog will supposedly see its shadow and retreat back for another 6 weeks of winter. That word stuck in my throat here. The largest groundhog celebration in the world is in Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. They must have heard how we did it up here in Canada, because they're trying hard to make it as outrageous as we've got it. But, you know, we'll give them points for it. They're a good time down there. Where we look for the first, we'll always look for first. It's part of what brings us to masonry. I always wondered who did it first. Well, it began as a Pennsylvania German custom in southeastern central Pennsylvania, somewhere in, I think, around the 18th or 19th centuries. But, and it does have origins in ancient European weather lore. about a badger or a sacred bear. It's the prognosticator. It gives it a little more valence, but hey, and it does have a little bit of a connection with a pagan festival of Imbolc. This was a seasonal turning point of the Celtic calendar, and that's celebrated on February 1st. And that involves weather prognostication, of course, and of course to St. Swithin's Day in July 15th. But the first documented American, you know, across the water reference to this was dated in February 4th, 1841, by a storekeeper, James Morris. So thank you, James, for doing that. The last Tuesday, the second, was Candlemas Day, the day on which, according to the Germans, the groundhog peeps out of its winter quarters and he sees his shadow. He pops back in for another 6 weeks to nap. But if the day is cloudy, he remains out, so the weather could be moderate. In Scotland, here's a beautiful little poem. If Candlemas Day is bright and clear, there'll be two winters in the year. If Candlemas be fair and bright, winter has another flight. If Candlemas bring clouds and rain, winter will not come again. So there you go. In Western countries in the Northern Hemisphere, the first official day of spring is almost 7 weeks away. So enough with the Groundhog Day. The big important thing for us, of course, is the vernal equinox. Yeah? 46 days, 15 hours, and 53 minutes. So that's the 20th of March, the first day of spring. Coming closer, 46 days away. Well, you know, you could hold off washing the Buick that long, can't you? I think so. We have a few things on the go today, and I'm fascinated by the work of right now of Matthew Arnold because he's explaining his work from 19th century is explaining so much that I think is relevant to the craft and that masons may enjoy and help them to reason through what the craft is all about. Are we convinced here that it's more than the bricks and mortar and the pretty clothes and the tributes and the accolades and titles? Okay, I agree. I hear the noise out there that it is more than that, much, much more, because somehow it's touched you intellectually, morally, and spiritually. So that is one of the starting points for masonry. We look beyond what we see. Now, I want you to help me here. And this is, I want to know if you're a Platonist or a nominalist as you're looking within yourself, as you're looking at this. Now, the Platonists say that things that are abstract do exist. Now, and I'm just glossing over this a quick, of course. So you may be, if you think that things, if we talk about things in abstraction, does that thing exist? You know, the duties of Freemasonry, you know, the deeper moral codes, say that's an abstraction. A nominalist say that unless a thing exists in time and space, it doesn't exist at all. Ah. But then, there you have it. You can be a Platonist without being a follower of the works and thinking of Plato. So think about that. Are you, as you we're going through the show today, Platonist, I guess, or a nominalist? At the end of the day, and as we're asking questions, you know, a good friend is sending me questions about our response to judgment and people being judged that people that have been accused of things. Well, I'm really struggling with this because I'm not sure if we're talking about the question is about justice or about something ethical. What's the right thing to do? Or justice and the law. The law isn't necessarily justice. It's not. A way of taking something, parsing something out so that we have a formula for justice that is less arbitrary and more. Less conceptual and more applied. And I guess, you know, I don't know where the applications of law begins and ends, but I do know the overriding blanket that we wrap it all in is ethics. So think about that as we move through this show today. Matthew Arnold, why Matthew Arnold? Here, I'll give you a little taste of why. The free thinking of one age is the common sense of the next. There. Now remember, before the brilliance, well, I shouldn't say the brilliance, eh? Before the order was anchored in 1717, before the constitutions of Anderson, you know, give him credit. Did he spin a lot? Absolutely. Did he make a lot of stuff up? Absolutely. Is he quoted as this being sort of small g gospel? Yeah. So not to be cruel to James, let's assume that he was of the order, and let's assume that a little bit of what he said made sense, that what he wrote made sense, but there's a little more to the craft than that. We knew that. And so enter into that sacred space that is the lodge. That's the kind of commonality I want to reach out, call out to, and welcome you into this sacred space. All the protections that provided by our Constitution and our Grand Lodge, the dodgy history that helps support that, we can find fact-based history that does support the progress, intellectual progress, and the banner that we call Freemasonry. It does, and it does us justice. So I don't mind the myths and I don't mind the stories, you know, made up. But at the end of the day, a serious-minded person is going to have to take a serious-minded approach to whether their beliefs are based on myths or not. Do you believe in Santa Claus? That's it. So here, Matthew Arnold says to us, culture is to know the best that has been said and thought in the world. And as you've heard me talk about before, an ill word, a harsh manner, a fellow who may have difficulties and troubles on his mind is given next to no credit or any slack. Maybe it's something very serious that's distracted the man. Maybe he's also a bit ill. Maybe he's worried. Maybe he doesn't have the connections and relationships to be able to self-actualize and get those feelings out there. Maybe pop psychology doesn't work for him. Or maybe some distraction doesn't work for him. And maybe when I come up and ask what I think is an innocent question and he's sharp with me, well, we know culturally when anybody is ever sharp with us, we don't give them any benefit of the doubt. We know that it's a deliberate act, and we can turn on our switch and release every bit of vitriol and negative temper, negativity, bad temper, ill manner toward that person. No one pulls one over on us, do they? Absolutely, and especially somebody that may have said something harsh or incomplete. It's justification. We can pull out our well-mannered, clean and pious middle-class and upper-middle-class values allow us to dump all over that creature. And I say, where did that rule come from that it was okay? Where did it? Okay, no, it's a little more than the golden rule, but it is like that. Where did that come from? In real life, where we just feel like it's a reflex. Ha, gotcha now. I can be nasty, mean, and slag you forever. Oh, and by the way, I can do that behind your back. And as long as I do that behind your back with Masons who also do that behind the back, then it's okay, isn't it? It's part of Masonry. It's part of Masonry, but it's not okay. It's the shame of the order. Truth sits upon the lips of dying men, says Matthew Arnold. I'm thinking we should, I would invite you to look at his work on criticism. Yes, and curiosity. And we forget because we must and not because we will. It is almost impossible to exaggerate the proneness of the human mind to take miracles as evidence and to seek for miracles as evidence. Spare me the whispering crowded room, the friends who come and gape and go, the ceremonious air of gloom, all which makes death a hideous show. Well, let's sit down and have a conversation over a cup of tea. Eh? Poetry, he says, is simply the most beautiful, impressive, and widely effective mode of saying things. If you're not prone to it, it's an area of your training that you need to refine. Nobody's going to do it for you. You're a grown man or a grown woman. I hope there's women masons listening in. Poetry is simply the most beautiful, impressive, and widely effective mode of saying things. I heard a nice quote that poetry is a means for the world to express emotion. You know, it goes beyond what we can convey in a language. But today, I want to talk about the secret cycle of masonry. You mind? I hope you don't mind. What we see today makes us unhappy, I think. And that is the subtext for masonry. It's not fluff. It's not like every day is a shiny day and every day is Christmas. No. All the unhappiness that we see going around, that's subtext for us. We believe what we want to believe. See what we want to see. The unvarnished truth is assumed to be painfully unnecessary. Generations before us write about hubris, dwindling interest, myopic vision of the future, poor maintenance, glory that has lost. Realizing we no longer release our architects, engineers, and craftsmen to build us a cathedral. Not anymore, masonry. I suggest the order has been consistent from the very beginning, that this is the way we are today and have always been so. The epoch ever only existed in the mind, a pastiche of aspiration. In this episode, we approach our work with two aspects in mind, Alpha and Omega. Introspective or gregarious influences how we go about engagement and performance. I suggest masonry has dark matter, a mass larger than what we perceive. Masonic dark matter. The intellect of craft masonry has been preserved, passed through streams of ideas and observations that contain the Freemasonry. Whether we grasp this process or not rests on differences of ability that naturally exist between men. What we see is insignificant compared to what we represent. Can we or should we leave a symbol for future generations? Nostalgia drives many of us to preserve lodges that have served their purpose. Periodically, unstoppable corrective adjustments happen. Lodges come, lodges go. Our largest organizations and networks continually release retrograde pressure this way. It's not affirming, it's part of it. And why do we struggle so much? Lodges go dark, chapters go dark, orders go dark. As if, in the mind, that's something wrong. Something's wrong when an old friend dies. He should be a machine and never die. His skin should be metal, not corrode. So difficult for us to embrace the nature of life around us and us as a part of it. What a simple little order we've become if that's all there is. We cannot change the perfect mathematics of existence. But that does not stop us from trying. It's natural that membership rises and falls, interest gains and fades. And the stream of ethics, philosophy, and insight keeps flowing through time. There is a beginning, so there must be an end. Yeah? Depends. Strings or loops? Come to the Masonic Exchange, we talk. The stream, the strength, the value, the point, the purpose of Freemasonry continues regardless of our limits. In spite of our failings and inadequacies, in spite of it, it exists. I'm a Platonist. Those ideas exist, and they exist in real time, in time and space, not ever controlled by the likes of us, not ever controlled by the likes of any group of people. They are what they are. Now we can portray ourselves as disciples of this great order and these remarkable ideas. But what kind of students and disciples are we if we haven't learned the lessons of the Master? All he's done is tried to feed it to us, to show us, to put it under our feet. But he cannot pick it up for us. He cannot think it for us. He cannot be it for us. We can dress up as happy little penguins. It doesn't make us a happy little penguin. Doesn't make us clever. Doesn't make us good students. Never to criticize other people. No, we're really in need of a deep look into the mirror ourselves. And we see the nature of Freemasonry when we do that. And in this mirror, we can become aware of the cycle. Just like when a snowstorm comes, you'll see people running out saying, "See, there's no climate change. We have lots of water coming down around us here." Well, what they're talking about is weather, not climate. "Oh, well, we don't get any attendance, so, you know, there's something wrong with the order. We have to recruit. We have to compromise. We have to scrape away some of the ethics that we've agreed to. Put a cloth over them so they don't see what we're doing." Really? We're happy to quarrel about the weather, complain about it, but the climate of Freemasonry is much deeper, long-standing, complicated, and not necessarily evident. I see weather when I look out the window. Do I see climate? Yeah, in a sense I do. But if it's sunny tomorrow, that doesn't mean climate change. If it's sunny and warm and unusually warm next week, that doesn't mean the weather I'm seeing is the climate. I'm seeing a little tiny part of it. And that's what we see in the when we do these scans of masonry. Funny, isn't it? We put our emphasis into money and administration. Odd, don't you think? Necessary, but it's like one leg on a farmer's stool. What about the other two legs? So we've got the one-legged stool that you sit on in the monasteries, eh? If you fall asleep, you fall off your stool. So meditate quietly. It's talk about some things that I think we learn a lot from the fundamentals. And I hope I haven't fallen into that trap that I talk about so readily, hearing the same thing referred to over and over and over again. And yes, I know that it's probably different every time an entered apprentice discovers the meaning of a symbol or discovers that symbols exist. We need to be able to share that happiness with them. But after a while, what happens to the cohort of older Masons? I think they crave something a little more. And I don't think that's ever been any different. I think that's the nature of one of the functions of the craft, for the older mentors to pass on to the younger apprentices the teachings, some of the ideas about how they approach the form and design and the execution of the ideas. And that does go on within the craft of what, 41,000 around us. We do see that going on. This idea that we should see it, we should franchise it, and every lodge should be doing that, it strikes me as remarkably odd. So go and buy yourself, go and look and search online for this. Joseph Campbell and the Power of Myth. It's a 1988 PBS documentary. Remarkable. He's sitting down with Bill Moyers. Some of you will remember Bill Moyers. It's absolutely fascinating. I won't even begin to touch on the topics. The chapters go something like this: Myth and Modern World, The Journey Inward, The First Storytellers, Sacrifice and Bliss, The Hero's Adventure, Gift of the Goddess, The Tale of Buddha, The Masks of Eternity, Tales of Love and Marriage. Yes. I found Joseph Campbell, a very stimulating and interesting person to listen to. Just a great mind. I'm very sorry that he's not with us anymore. Died in 1987. So, he left a lot of work that behind that I think really would strengthen the understanding of, deepen the understanding of Masons. Remarkably, and probably be a service to the craft instead of being embarrassed. There are actually people that work very hard, and when they come up with the work in their own labs and their own libraries, and they're trying to pull it together, they don't always make sense. That's how we refine these problems. We talk about it, and we're challenged back and forth. We look at the work. This is brilliant. Well, you could do better. Really? And always we can. That's the notion of the critic, the critique, to force that, to perfect that curiosity. But I want to talk to you about duty. I remember we were talking about the three obligations that a man has, piety, or men's duty toward God, righteousness, or the duty of men toward one another, and sobriety, or men's duty toward themselves. So Thomas Wise, also someone observant of his threefold duty of a man and a Christian, is pious and devout toward God, just and kind to other men, moderate and sober as to himself. By 1734, we find these three general heads of duty, which Masons ought always to inculcate to God, our neighbors, and ourselves, each with its explanation, in the charge to newly admitted brethren. The Church came close to identifying the moral law with the Ten Commandments. This created some consistency problems, as the universal moral law was written in the heart of a man, while the Ten Commandments were part of the Scriptures. In an explicatory catechism, we read, "The moral law is summarily comprehended in the Ten Commandments." Though without the light of the Scriptures, there cannot be so clear a discovery of the moral law, yet by the light of nature it is made known unto all nations in some measure, sufficient to leave every heathen without excuse for their disobedience. Some, saying that one contained the other, would simply identify both. The moral law contains the Decalogue, or Ten Commandments, which are the dictates of natural light, or the rules of a holy life. The moral law, or those precepts of natural light, summed up and delivered in the Ten Commandments. The moral law, or the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments contain purely moral laws, but they deal also with the acknowledging God and observing the Sabbath. As for the latter, there has always been some doubt whether observing the Sabbath was a truly moral law and not some positive law. The Catechism needed special arguments to convey that this fourth commandment concerning the weekly Sabbath was moral and binding upon all nations, and that throughout all generations. But there were other opinions like this. The Sabbath, as our Lord said, was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. 'Twas not God's design we should rest in formalities and be enslaved to the strict letter of his positive laws. But it has never been doubted that the moral law forbids atheism. In the moral law, which is the rule of good works, this first commandment, which concerns the acknowledgement of God, forbiddeth these sins. The sin of atheists who acknowledge and know God. The sin of such as serve false gods. The sin of such as serve not the true God, onely and aright. Atheists, deists, and Christians. Now, you wanted probably need, we need to stop here just for a second. Atheists, and you probably have a sense of what atheists mean, and Christians, but deism, and that is taken from a Latin word deus, meaning God, and it combines a rejection of religious knowledge as a source of authority with the conclusion that reason and observation of the natural world are sufficient to determine the existence of a single creator of the universe. So all religious knowledge on the shelf, we're able to reason through and observe in the natural world and find sufficient information, fact, to determine the existence of a single creator of the universe, deism. And that gained prominence among intellectuals during the Age of Enlightenment, especially in Britain and France and Germany. Age of Enlightenment was from about the 1650s to the 1780s, and it was a cultural and intellectual event. You've heard me talk about that. We've done that different times. The boys that poured out of that were Francis Bacon and René Descartes and John Locke, and an exceptional mind, I want to point out, Baruch Spinoza. Just either pre-Masonic corporation or just during and after. Voltaire, David Hume, Immanuel Kant, and then, of course, Isaac Newton. We've talked quite a bit about the work of Isaac Newton. So the atheists, deists, and Christians in London around 1720, religion usually meant Christianity, as in the following citation by Thomas Wise, "He who has any true sense of religion does at once respect the ministers of it, and I defy any person to show me a truly good Christian in other respects who is not at once a lover of the clergy." Some were aware of other religions, though, like Thomas Hearne, referring to his Doctor Historicus, to all religion, particularly the Jewish and Christian. Every now and then, religious could refer to natural religion. When Chamberlain left out of his Newite translation all biblical arguments, changing the title from the Christian philosopher to the religious philosopher, reflected passing from revealed religion to natural religion. And for Bacon, Francis Bacon, religion is the opposite of atheism, as is de Saulier's religious sense of God's wisdom and providence. The world existed to atheists, deists, and Christians. Atheists denied either the very existence of God or some of his essential attributes. For instance, identifying God with nature. Deists believed in God, but not in revelation. They were also called infidels or unbelievers. Nguyen explains that he wrote his book to convince atheists of the power, wisdom, and goodness of God, the maker and ruler of all things, and infidels, who indeed acknowledge a God but reject the authority of the holy writings, that the scriptures are of a more than humane original. And he calls his audience the atheist and infidel, and atheists and unbelievers. Atheists, deists, and Christians came in different sorts. Samuel Clarke distinguished in his demonstration three sorts of atheists and in his discourse four sorts of deists. The latter agree in rejecting the authority of the Bible, but differ in what they do admit. Classified in decreasing order of wickedness, deists could believe in a creator, but not in providence. In a providential creator, not judging in good and evil, and a providential creator judging on good and evil, but not in an immortal soul, and a providential creator judging on good and evil, and in an immortal soul, but not in the authority of the Bible. Unlike atheists, deists base their opinions not on the principles of reason alone, but also on testimony and evidence of matter of fact. Could you see initiating a deist into the lodge? The Bible, including the New Testament, Jews would probably be classified with the deists. Atheism was thought to be so logically inconsistent that only madmen or perverts could be convinced of it. Many claimed that there was no such thing as a genuine atheist and adapted their terminology accordingly. The borderline between atheist and deist, and between their different sorts, was ill-defined and changed with fashion and personal conviction. Thus, opposers of providence are atheists for de Saulier and deists for Clarke. Some allowed for decent atheists and deists, but most were convinced that man went effectively immoral as soon as there was no punishment to be feared. Well, let's get right down to it. But unless there's the threat of punishment, we become immoral. Therefore, immorality is often seen to be intrinsically linked to atheists and deists. The desire to live an immoral life is often the ultimate explanation for rejecting what theologians and preachers considered to be reason itself. The age was very much under the influence of Newton's amazing achievements in science. Many copied the style of his Principia Mathematica and claimed to have been proving propositions, sometimes throwing in genuine scientific arguments involving gravitation or mathematics. Any theological position was declared to be proved by reason, and any opposing view was proved to be folly or unreasonableness. Terms like stupid, sottish, absurd, foolish, mad, ignorant, and senseless abounded. Here's a phrase you've heard. stupid atheists, a sort of deists. Masons, obliged to obey the moral law, cannot be atheists. On the other hand, they, or at least those who don't yet understand the art rightly, can be stupid atheists. That only makes sense if stupid atheists are no atheists. Strange as it may sound, this is exactly the case. People who did not philosophically deny God's existence, but lived as if he did not exist, were called practical atheists. The adjective meaning by behavior, not by opinion. The notion and the terminology occur already in 1664 in a sermon by John Tillotson. He was later the Archbishop of Canterbury. And by 1708, both had made it into church catechism. The terminology was most misleading because everyone agreed and said so, that practical atheists were no speculative Mason atheists at all. Some classified them nonetheless with the atheists and others with the deists. Clark's deists, 1 and 2, considered therefore together for that purpose. Remember 1 and 2? Wiccan deists who believe in a creator but not in providence, and in a providential creator not judging on good or evil. Is that the sense of a creator that is a guide, a mentor, a support, a point of reflection, a sense of insight? I think I might be one of those. This behavior includes those aspects which Anderson's contemporaries identified most with libertinism, namely the dreaded libertine wit. They endeavor to ridicule and banter all humane as well as divine accomplishments, ridiculing whatever bears any resemblance to it, God's wisdom and men, turning everything alike and without exception into ridicule and banter. These things, true, honest, just, pure, lovely, of good report, they make the subject of their constant drollery and abuse, ridicule and raillery. Such men as these are not to be argued with, till they can be persuaded to use arguments instead of drollery. The marginal note says profane and debauched deists, not capable of being argued with. The adjectives refer to the very profane and very lewd images of debauched and vitious inclinations of both sorts of deists. Here, profane seems to have the meaning characterized by disregard or contempt of sacred things. Among these, regretting the misleading noun and impractical atheists was Thomas Wise. In 1706, he published a confutation of the reason and philosophy of atheism. It was an attempt to prove the long and muddled classic, The True Intellectual System of the Universe. Its author, Ralph Cudworth, was professor of Hebrew, philosopher, and leader of the remarkable group known as the Cambridge Platonists. And Wise states, "Not, after all, that I suppose there are or ever have been any absolute speculative atheists, or such as fully answer that character, being thoroughly grounded and convinced in their minds that there is no God." He's saying, nope, they didn't exist. And then he goes on, "Therefore, I could wish that the term atheist, as men are apt to understand it in this sense, were not so generally used." After some examples of historical figures falsely called atheists, we find those and some others who have heretofore come under the character, yet were not atheists in the sense of before mentioned, but either opposers or deriders of the national superstition, or else they have been so called, at least in the latter, for the following senses: in that I own that two sorts of men, making, alas, too great a part of the world, might in all ages come under that name. First, such as Cudworth distinguishes by the appellation stupid atheists. Inasmuch they cannot reason of the matter, but being already great sinners and willing to continue such, they cannot away with the thoughts of that God from whom they can look nothing but vengeance. But to divert their reason and stupefy their conscience by hurry and intemperance, till at length custom gets the better and benumbing of their intellectual powers. Secondly, there is another sort of atheists, who, having, like the former, a bent to impiety, and so the same prejudice against God take upon them to philosophize about the point and principles of reason to dispute his existence, or at least to advance such notions of him as imply that he is not infinitely perfect, and so, in effect, that he is not at all. Being not able to convince themselves fully that there is no God, yet venturing to live as if there were. And these are the great champions and upholders of the former, that is, the stupid atheists, or ignorant, ungodly men. So if I hold the sense that what God represents is perfection and insight, and that my life would be, our lives are spent striving, but never achieving, although we're living in the likeness of the God. There's no script that tells us how to perform work. There's social convention. You know, from the pilgrims, it said, walk this way, dress this way, serve your religion this way, and tended to be a bit overbearing, expecting that other people would do the same. Here we have the term stupid atheists. They are practical atheists. Yeah? So it says wise on the subject. But as for practical atheists, or such as in plainer English we might have termed ungodly men, in that they live without God in the world and have him not in all their thoughts, and who, though not pretending on rational grounds to deny the existence of God, yet do presume to lead their lives as if there were none. Of such, I say, there have been great numbers in all times and places. And these are the persons who, in King David's language, do justly come under the character of the fool. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Enough. This is a dry meal. This is a dry banquet that we've sat down at. Your tumbler's not full of wine or ale, but spring water. We're having a talk about what we talk about. We talk about the libertine, the atheist, and the deists. Now we can question whether we should understand what those terms are about. I don't think a lot of us are going to crack a book and start to study this stuff easily. I think if this is one of those topics that's easier to approach and sneak up on it when we're in a group, so we can share that befuddled look. And we have to get over it. I think the group, the lodge, gives us support to do that. We would tend to just roll our eyes and say, oh no, we can't get into this. This must be horrible. It must be something that I can't understand, and it doesn't have relevance to my life. Well, what that is the effect of these types of lessons on the mind of a boy. sitting there full of energy, distracted by what's going on outside the window in his church or synagogue or temple. And now, as a mature mind, is stopped and asked if he can understand the distinctions that he's making in his mind toward other people and himself. So we can support one another in this step, because Masonry has that sense about it where the absolute nature of religion is not so absolute inside the doors of a lodge, the walls of a lodge, where there's active discussion and challenge going on inside those walls, or ought to be, so that we can begin to know what we know and refute what we don't know, or what we're claiming to know that's wrong. So we'll come back to this a little bit. This is from Wise Again. Stupid by his own ignorant, or David's fool. In his linguistic analysis, he claims that St. Paul's Greek word for foolish in Romans 10, verse 9, meaning imprudent without understanding, refers to the same. Generally, stupid meant having one's faculties deadened or dulled, apathetic or indifferent. So when we're talking about stupid, or the word for foolish, it means imprudent, without understanding. It's not to say the mind doesn't have the ability, just that snapshot, this is imprudent. It has long been debated whether Anderson's stupid atheist is an atheist, hence stupid, or an atheist of the stupid sort. Wise's stupid atheist is neither. But someone living like an atheist while not being one, hence stupid, ignorant, foolish, and imprudent. Stupid atheists are, philosophically speaking, no atheists at all. They believe in God and say so publicly. Inconsideration or a neglect to think about God, his attributes, etc., this being undoubtedly a general source of irreligion and impiety, nay, of all the practical atheism and ungodly living which is now so rife and common in the world, where it is too often seen that multitudes of persons, however they profess, and this truly too, that they know God, yet do in works deny him, being abominable and disobedient, and unto every work of good a reprobate. Sort of makes you begin to think about the world that we live in. Huh. Ernie, thumbs up, thumbs down, like, dislike. Let's get into the meaning of a bit more. We're going to talk about irreligious libertines and other sorts of deists, and scoffing at religion and sexual debauchery and observing religious duties loosely or not at all. I'm being of the Church of England, and I'm a fallen. I don't know if you know, I know my friends talk to me about being fallen Catholics. I don't think I've fallen off anything. But the practices, the rituals are wonderful because they connect me over the course of an entire year to anticipating what's coming next and what I'm doing now. And isn't that what all bright people do? Isn't that really what this is all about? That sense of anticipation, trying to understand what's coming around us and what's going on, because it will prepare us for what's coming next, and prepare us not to waste the precious time that we have today. Gotta love Freemasonry, don't you? Don't be afraid. Don't, absolutely. There's no reason to be sitting there like a little automaton, nodding your head and going through mouthing the words. the lights have to go on behind those eyes. Be true to yourself. Don't be saying you understand something when you don't. No need to lie to yourself. Absolutely no need. You're respected for not understanding. And when you look at somebody that claims to have all that understanding, you might ask yourself, what the hell are they doing with us? They have all the answers. What the hell are they doing with us? We're out there trying to be good students. And the way we start is by accepting the question, can we get better? Yeah. But we need to be able to pay attention. Attention to what? To the symbols, perhaps? Maybe. You know, maybe. So enjoy. Absolutely enjoy this. This doesn't have to be droll. And you bring your personality to it. Not funeral directors. We're not living in a sense of despair. If you're wearing a hair shirt, take it off. I say that out loud. Take it off. No need to pretend that you need to suffering in order to find. You're not going to parallel suffering with something that's... You're not going to make something conceptual into something existential. Ah, we get enough of that nonsense going on, where people can have a whole well-formed belief that's their belief, and then they think they make that mistake. It's a concept. Are they nominalists? Or are they Platonists? Enough to justify murdering people that aren't of their belief. This isn't new. Not new at all. It's remarkably thick. It still goes on, and it will probably always go on, and people, good people, like-minded people, will stand up and put an end to it in a way that they would choose unwillingly, but forced to out of necessity. Do we allow this type of thinking to overpower the work of other people who haven't come to their conclusions? Live your life as you need. Whatever part of the lessons you're in, if you're at the very beginning of your study, the very start of enlightenment, good for you. But remember, other people might be a little further downstream. Some might have taken a side journey to find out what that tributary in their mind was all about. At the end of the day, we can look at each other and say, yeah, we're students. We have much to learn. The world is full of fascination. And just when you think you understand something, there's something else comes along. Just when you have those days where you wish that you could just dumb it down and keep it all simple, and that the lodge wouldn't let politics and personality and ego leak into it, it always happens. So accept it. No sense pulling our hair out and running shrieking into the woods. There's times when, if you're a contemplative man, you'll need to step back. Be respected for that, and think things through for yourself, by yourself. And above all, there comes a time when the Master Mason needs to be able to speak his own mind, not just to speak foolishness, or to speak rashly or intemperately, but to speak because he has something to say that's worth listening. Always an absolute distinct pleasure. Oh, yes, I forgot that some of us will be caught up with American sports later this afternoon. anything to sell and make a profit, I guess. And some of you will still be today getting prepared for the out-of-control celebrations for Groundhog Day tomorrow. Whatever is your poison, brethren, I hope that the show has been useful for you today, and will add a small element to your learning. It's an amazing order that we are has accepted us into its ranks, and we're very fortunate. And we're going to finish off the show. You know, I always play a little bit of music and see if you can pick out the themes here, just things that occur to me. And it just seemed important for me today to think about the very best rock and roll song of all time. Now, to all the despots out there, to all the people that have ridiculous notions of suppressing the freedoms of their people, I'm going to share with you, we're going to share with you on Masonic Exchange, the biggest threat of them all. The biggest threat to your autocratic despotism and dictatorial notions. Here it is, boys and girls. The biggest threat of them all. We should have done away with rock and roll when we had a chance, but their little girls and their little boys are going to one day hear this on the wind, and after that, there's no, once the genie's out of that bottle, well, we know where that goes. This is just too much fun. Here's the greatest rock and roll song acclaimed by polls around the world of all time. Thank you. Brethren, you celebrate every moment. Every moment. So Dylan's old, but you know what I mean about the threat. How do you stop that? You just don't. So the genie's out of the bottle again. You boys have a good time. I'll see you later.
Thank you. Yeah!